This is The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167.
Hello and welcome to The Feed with Amber Mack.
And Michael B. for everything new now and next.
We have you covered for what's happening in the world of tech and what's trending online.
On the show, why Sheryl Sandberg is leaving Facebook after 14 years.
Plus, the latest on why Elon Musk thinks working from home is fake news.
Also on the show, how Margaret Atwood is raising literary awareness with a book burning.
And we also talk about technology that could make biking safer.
That's all coming up right here on The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B.
Trending up.
Well, I'm so sorry, buddy. You aren't feeling very well. I feel bad for you. I've had COVID 3 times. I've had the flu 2 times already because I've been in different countries. And you're a little under the weather, but you still sound fun and exciting, and we're going to have a great show.
Yes, mostly I'm just losing my voice on and off, which is great when you're a speaker and work in broadcast.
For a living, yeah. Every single day you interview people and there's no one to, this is the other thing I think it's funny people forget. There's no one to replace you when you are sick. So you're just not allowed to get sick.
Yeah. I mean, I will say that I do feel very grateful to be able to do my job virtually. So, you know, my fear right now is not necessarily me. You know, I'm getting over it. I'm not contagious anymore. Again, you know, just being able to not expose anyone and still work virtually has been really a blessing in many ways.
Please don't lose your voice.
Yes. There's been a couple of rough moments. But nonetheless, we have a lot to talk about today. And Michael, I believe you're back in Canada. It's hard to keep up.
Yes, so I got in late last night, and so I'm back in Toronto. So I was in Australia, and I made my way back. I forget just how long it is, and I do not enjoy flying. I don't enjoy the experience. I don't enjoy traveling. So, I mean, lines, waiting, it's just horrendous. But I am back in Toronto, and my mom is doing a little bit better. So obviously, it was very sad to be in Australia for the reason I was there, but she's a little bit stronger today, and I checked in with them. So positive onward and upwards.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's definitely not an easy thing to be that far away, but it was good that you got to go home. So we do have a lot to cover in our trending up this week. First up, we wanted to talk about Sheryl Sandberg. She is leaving Facebook after 14 years. If you don't follow Facebook closely, you may think to yourself, well, who the heck is that? And wanted to make clear that, you know, she's really been Mark Zuckerberg's right-hand person over more than a decade. I think that's a fair way to put it, Michael.
Yeah, I think so. And I think also you have to remember anytime anything bad happened, it felt like this was the person they trotted out because she was female and because she seemed to be more empathetic and she seemed to say the right things better than other people. That's probably the most polite way I can say this. I'm sure also within her own right, she's exceptionally experienced, but I think that she had a very, very, very tough role with Facebook, now Meta. So, you know, she lasted 14 years.
Yeah, right. I mean, and it's going to be interesting to see what she does. She has a relatively good reputation, but nonetheless, just wanted to share. We have a lot more news as well. Just quickly, I don't want to spend more than maybe 10 seconds on this. Elon Musk, a memo was leaked that basically he has told his employees to return to work or else, proving that he is a bigger jerk than I initially thought. That probably covers that one.
It's so interesting to see many, many, many CEOs all over the world adapting and changing. Whether we need to be in the office or not, whether it's because of COVID or not, I don't really think it's a debate about, COVID changed the way we do things. I don't think that's the case, but I think it goes to show the type of leader you are. If you listen to your employees and if they are, you know, you give them a better environment, you give them better benefits and better options. And for example, working, you know, a couple of days a week at home and a couple of days a week in the office and just being flexible and evolving with the times, mm-hmm. I think that's one type of leader. And then there's another.
Yeah. And you know what? Here's the thing. You know what? If those are your rules, those are your rules. But if you actually go and read the email, there's not one person who can convince me that that was a kind and empathetic email. That was a threatening email. And in 2022, we expect better from our leaders. Speaking of awesome people, though, we want to talk for a second about Margaret Atwood. So she appears in
Love
this
it. I love
video.
her so much.
It's so cool, where she is basically trying to ignite a very special edition of The Handmaid's Tale, her very famous book.
Cost a
Thankfully,
fortune too, and she's like, let's just like burn it.
oh yeah. So thankfully, the whole gist of it is that you're not able to burn it because it is printed on fire-resistant paper. But she has a flamethrower, and she's trying. And this is all part of a fundraiser to raise awareness about the number of books that are getting banned in U.S. schools. So this particular version of Margaret Atwood's book is unburnable, and they're auctioning it off to raise money. And last time I looked, it was at $100,000 US to get the unburnable
Amazing.
book. So a very cool online video that you probably saw. And what a great campaign, and everything she does is kind of clever.
Well, this is what I was going to say, just on that. If you don't follow her on Twitter, if you're not familiar with her outside of just her books, she is a fascinating person. And I'm so grateful I was introduced to her by you, Amber, in the early days when we started working together. And she is somebody that has evolved and stays relevant no matter what. And and also uses her platform for the right reasons, and just a sheer delight, very intelligent, very talented, and hilarious on Twitter if you do not follow her on social.
Absolutely. Just quickly, we wanted to bring our producer Aaron into this next story. So follow Margaret Atwood. Also, check this out. This is a really incredible story that was in the BBC News, and it's all about a device called Tether that helps to detect risky routes for cyclists. So basically, it uses lasers so that it's a device that goes on the bike that has these lasers that go kind of on either side of the bike. When it detects a car has come into your own bike zone, it will start to map areas where that happens more often, and they could be unsafe. Aaron, over to you. You are the cyclist. What do you think of this?
This sounds like a great idea. I do a lot of urban cycling in Toronto where I live. I try to stick to areas with marked bike paths, and you can't always do that. So anything to increase cyclist safety, I support. But I think that this could be useful not just to crowdsource safety from cyclist to cyclist, but this data could maybe be brought to local councillors and city planners to show where more bike protective infrastructure and bike lanes are needed. I know in this city of Toronto, it's often a battle to get bike lanes painted, and there's a lot of pro car councillors, a lot of pro bike councillors, a lot of in betweens. And sometimes people need to be convinced why bike safety is and bike infrastructure is necessary. And this could help, not just, as I said, the users, maybe brought to a local government level.
My quick question there is, what do you find more? Is it more cars drifting into bike lanes that are marked, or cyclists drifting out of the lanes when they are marked for cyclists? Is one a little bit more prevalent than the other?
The short answer, when I'm on the roads, I see everyone breaking every rule. Cyclists, cars, buses, pedestrians, everyone breaks every rule. But for cyclists, not just marked, but with a physical barrier is what I prefer. A low concrete barrier or pylons is always better than just paint markings.
Well, it sounds like this technology could help nevertheless. So stay with us when we return. Everything you need to know about a new robot beekeeper.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167. Techstar.
You're listening to The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. Now, did you know that more than 70% of crops, almost all fruit and vegetables, oil seeds and protein crops, spices, coffee and cocoa, they all depend very heavily on the ability for bees to pollinate plants? Now, the number of bee colonies is decreasing at an alarming rate due to habitat loss, the use of pesticides, diseases, and parasites. So it's not good news, but one Israeli startup, Beewise, could be their hero with their robot beekeeper solution. So to share all about it, Zah Zafra is joining us. He is the co-founder and CEO of Beewise. Now, this is fantastic, using artificial intelligence. So let's start from the beginning. We understand the severity of the problem, but how do you go about fixing such a large problem and bringing technology into the space?
So hi, thank you for having me, first of all. You know, the idea of bee collapse or colony collapse disorder, CCD, as it's called in the professional jargon, is a severe issue. As you mentioned, 75% of all the food and vegetables on the planet are pollinated by bees. And so the idea is that when we founded the company, we realized we're not going to be able to solve the externalities. So climate change and pesticides and so on, it's too big of a problem, and it's global, and it's entrenched in the in novel agriculture. So what we said to ourselves is, can we equip the bees with a toolbox to actually cope with such modern stressors, such as climate change or global warming? And so we built a device that actually tends to the bees in real time in the field. The device is essentially a box that houses the bees. It's like a beehive, but a little bit bigger. It contains multiple colonies. And using a lot of artificial intelligence, machine learning, and precision robotics, the actual device is able to identify the specific challenges bees are facing. For example, lack of forage. So they're hungry. So there's hunger. It can provide them some food, both protein and carbs, or lack of water, or too hot or too cold. It can regulate temperature and humidity. And all those things are relatively simple to do once you identify the issue in the field. And for that, you need very strong AI and machine learning capabilities.
It is pretty incredible to see how it works. And I have many technical questions, but I can't help the fact that top of mind for me is that I recently met a beekeeper who was very proud of his job and his bees and kind of the fine art of beekeeping. So can you talk a little bit about how this maybe takes humans out of the mix, or how important humans still are in terms of making this successful?
So, you know, the beehives we see in the fields, you know, the white boxes, I should say 150-year-old white boxes, because that's when they were invented, are very romantic, and beekeepers love their work. But when you think about feeding 8 billion people on the planet, 8 billion, and everybody understands today on the planet that vegetables, fruit, seeds, nuts are important. I mean, you can live off of rice and corn all your life, but it won't be a healthy life. So you know, more people are coming out of poverty, more people are being born, global populations are growing, and so there's more demand for a healthy diet, which includes fruit and vegetables, which are pollinated by bees, most of which. And so the idea is that, you know, we're dependent on the bees, and we have to make sure that they help us at scale. So again, if you have a couple of hives in your backyard, or if you're a sideliner or a hobbyist beekeeper, you love your bees, you can still do the 150-year-old hives and do that. But for the rest of the 99 million hives on the planet, which need to feed many mouths, it's not about romance. It's about how you keep the bees alive in a scalable and cost-effective manner, so that our avocado doesn't cost us an arm and a leg to buy because pollination is so scarce and so expensive. So again, at scale, it's all about cost savings, accessibility, and just being able to do it on a global manner.
So speaking of that scalability that you're referring to, can you give us some examples just how more, how beneficial is it, this solution, as opposed to the way it's done now? What kinds of, crop yields, what results are we seeing in regards to increased crop yields, or what kinds of a drop in, deaths of the bees? And why does that matter? I guess if you can paint a picture, how valuable is it, to a community, as opposed to, as you were saying, if it was a beekeeper who was a hobbyist, for example?
So, I'll give you a specific example, but you can kind of, you'll be able to conclude from that on the bigger picture. So, take January, February, they're usually cold months, but this March, this last coming March, the one that we just had, was really warm in certain states. And what happened is it kind of woke up the bees from their winter sleep. They don't really sleep during winter, but they're kind of a little bit hibernated. It woke them up, but then April went back to normal. That's a catastrophe for a bee colony. Bees have been around for 250 million years. They're part of nature. You know, they complement flowers. very closely. They're the only thing that actually pollinates, moves pollen from the female flower to the male flower. And so if something like that happened, for example, a very weird month, like too cold or too warm, and doesn't follow the standard pattern of seasonality, it's very harmful to the bees. Now, if you're a backyard beekeeper, you can go and put some blankets around your bees, or you can spray some water to cool the hive if it's too warm. But when you're a commercial beekeeper and you have 10,000 colonies in the fields, pollination, the almonds, you really can't do much. You can't do almost anything. What you do is you come a month later and you realize, you know, half of my hives have collapsed. Or another example, you know, if there's pesticides, if you put your hives now in avocado pollination and the growers have to apply pesticides, they spray their fields and it kills the bees as well. What are you going to do when you have 10,000 colonies in the fields? You really can't do much. Just taking them out of the fields will take you 2 weeks. And they have to spray now because there's some pests on the avocados. And so there's a big difference between a backyard beekeeper that does it as a hobby and can really treat their bees or attend their bees in a very intimate fashion versus scalable treatment and growing bees.
We just have about a minute left. So one question for you. You say on your website that bees come first. And I wanted to just know, just for a final question, how optimistic are you that this can, you know, quickly have an effect on basically the future of bees?
In the world today, we see about a 35% global collapse of bees every single year over year, despite, you know, all the global efforts to stop this decline. I mean, think about global warming. This is happening now. This is not happening in 100 years. This is happening now. We're losing 35% of the global bees every year. In our devices, we lose 7% of the bees. So the difference, we get to save about 28-30% of the bees that would have died otherwise. I'm very optimistic because now it becomes of scaling our solution. It's not a matter of can we solve the problem. It's solvable. Can we scale fast enough before we get past the point of no return where the bee population can't really kind of overcome these losses? And I'm very optimistic.
Well, listen, we wanted to thank you so much for joining us today. And just quickly, for anyone who wants to follow your company, where's the best place to go?
Beewise.ag, our website.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much for being on the feed.
Thank you for having me.
Up next, we'll tell you about a patient app that will help hospital emergency visits feel a lot safer.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167. Apptastic.
This week's Apptastic segment is powered by Ecobee. Ecobee just launched their best thermostats yet, including a beautiful new design inside and out. The all-new Smart Thermostat Premium and Smart Thermostat Enhanced includes a refreshed user interface and Ecobee's most advanced sensor technology to date with Braidar. So cool. Plus, Smart Thermostat Premium is the only smart thermostat with both an indoor air quality monitor and a smart speaker with your choice of Alexa or Siri, all encased in a stunning metal body. If you're looking to save up to 26% on your annual heating and cooling costs, head on over to Ecobee's website to invest in your comfort, your home health, and security needs. Ecobee's products are built to last in your home, not in a landfill, and the software is upgradable, so you'll always get the newest features and updates on their latest devices. And of course, they come with an app, so you can check it all via the app. All right, so speaking of apps, Michael, first up, we are going to talk about an app called Cabal, I believe, and it helps founders with sales, marketing, recruiting, and more. It's great for entrepreneurs.
Yeah, this one is really good because we talk a lot about small businesses and companies and startups. And it's interesting, a lot of the people that we speak to, you know, often, you know, are looking for resources and online communities where they can get the best support and not only be supported, but help with networking and finding the right tools they might need to help scale their business and also tools that help them when they're looking at investors, for example, or what are the expectations they should get from investors? So all those questions that kind of come into play when you're running your own business or your startup and you're looking to expand. And so I thought it was a really good idea to bring up this app because it kind of seems to bring it all into the one place and bring this community together and answer those questions and also give those tools and resources and help you in every part of your business as you move forward and progress.
I love this. And you know what? I was reading recently, and I think I shared this in my newsletter, that up to 80% of businesses are small and medium-sized businesses. And I really believe that there's a huge opportunity. And I know there is some software and apps available for this audience, but I think there could be even more because these are organizations that don't have the money or investment that they can put into solutions and people to run their businesses. So anything where you can kind of fill the gap with tech, I think we're going to see more businesses try to target entrepreneurs. And this looks like a great example of that.
Absolutely. Because if you think about it, yeah, everything you just said, like they don't have a ton of money. They have to be very careful what they spend, not only from a financial perspective, but from a time perspective. So if you've got a network of supporters that genuinely want you to succeed, you know, and you're asking for help, whether it's, you know, help selling or market knowledge or finding the right people to join your company, you know, they can help guide you into all those areas because not everybody knows everything. And as we all know, you know, one person can't do it alone. So if you can find the right community to help you, you know, it's a win-win. So that one, Cable. So, Okamal, I can't remember what I
Cable, probably yep. Cable, maybe now that I look at it. all right. So, Michael, I do want to say that we're an inclusive show here on the feed. We have, in honor of our producer, Aaron, we have lots of technology from Israel. We have lots of tech from Australia. We're going to start a segment about technology from PEI pretty soon once we find some of that technology. So please tweet me. So, Michael, why don't you run with this next one? This is really such a good idea, the patient app in Australia that will help to compare hospital emergency department waiting times.
Yeah, so I thought this was really interesting because every country that I've been traveling to at the moment, the news seems to be very similar, and it's the health sector and medical facilities being pushed and stretched to their limits. And so what I liked about this was that the New South Wales government, they're one thing that they're trying to do, you know, is help kind of relieve some of that pressure when it comes to hospital emergency departments. And so what they're going to be doing is later on the year, they've got this app that's launching called the Patient App. And it's going to, you know, help people compare hospital emergency department waiting times and also give them the ability to book specialist appointments. The idea behind the app is to try and educate at the same time, but also give alternatives for people to seek treatment elsewhere and understand the different levels of treatment that you need. So not everybody is going straight to the nearest emergency department because a lot of people may not need to. And obviously, if everyone's going to the same place, that's going to get overloaded. And then those critical patients coming in might miss out, you know, or have trouble in getting the service and the help that they need. So I just thought this was a really good idea and one way to help, you know, alleviate the pressure to, you know, on the medical field, especially in Australia and New South Wales, but hopefully around the world, we start to see more of these types of apps.
Very cool. So the last one we're going to talk about is still in the healthcare space. It's called WellTrack, and it reminds me a lot of another app that I talk about in my presentations called Wobot. And this is
a sweet. That's the best name, sorry,
right?
From your presentation. Yeah,
it's really cool, and you should check out Wobot because it has some good reviews as well. But it's totally similar in the sense that what this is with WellTrack is that it helps you. It's interactive self help therapy. That's the way they describe it. So you would basically do like a daily mood check and you would be able to over time kind of monitor how you're feeling through the app. And Wobot does a similar thing. And what I found fascinating when I was researching Wobot, which is developed by Stanford University researchers, at least they've reviewed it. And what they say is that sometimes anonymous technology like this can really help people who are afraid to actually go see someone because of the stigma or the time or the expense. So there is this great gap that technology is filling when it comes to self-help.
I think that's the most important point that you made there, was there's still quite a lot of stigma attached to mental health or anyone asking for help if they don't think that they can cope with whatever's happening in their lives. And so I think apps like this that can help destigmatize those kinds of feelings so people can get help, I think are incredible. And so as you mentioned, you know, this app is fantastic. It's a suite of online tools. So there's it doesn't matter the level of help that you need. There's something here for everyone. And it is an ability for you to self-check in using cognitive behavioral therapy. It's helping you identify and understand and address the issues that you are having. So I think it's a fantastic app. So three very different apps. So that first one, Cable, that's helping founders. We've got residents in New South Wales going to be able to soon be able to use the Patient app. And then of course, that last one, the WellTrack app. And of course, we've also got EcoBee that we talked about, that's also sponsoring Apptastic, and it's a great product. So you can also check it out, and it has the accompanying app as well. Of course, if you've got an app, gadget, or product you think we should check out, tweet us at AmberMac and at MBancroft80. And of course, use the hashtag TheFeed. Coming up, how AI can predict dementia.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
You're listening to The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. Cognitivity Neurosciences has created an artificial intelligence tool that makes it possible for patients to take a test that could predict the potential onset of dementia. Joining us now to talk more about this is Dr. Sina Habibi, who is the co-founder and CEO. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, Amber. Thanks for having me.
All right. So let's first talk about dementia and how big of an issue this is around the world.
It's a huge, huge problem. Brain health in general is the biggest healthcare challenge of the 21st century. And dementia is a public health crisis point in most of affluent and even developing economies, even though the life expectancy is lower. This is a growing problem without any solution at the moment, but we're getting closer to having some better solution to deal with this, but it's a public health crisis.
Where we stand today, what does it look like when it comes to diagnosing people with dementia? And then how does that differ from what you guys have developed?
Today, the diagnostic pathway, the beginning of diagnosis is with what we call subjective memory complaint. Normally, patients go to their primary care physicians with a complaint about their memory. Often, not even themselves, their relatives report this. At that point, normally primary care physicians write a referral letter, send them to neurologists or psychiatrists, where a whole host of tests are administered, from neuropsychological tests to neuroimaging, blood, etc., etc. That gives enough information to a specialist to come to the conclusion whether someone has got dementia. What we do differently, we're looking at this more proactively. We have developed a technology which is very simple to use, and it's designed to pick up earliest changes in the brain in our cognition. And it's very well suited for primary care. The reason for this is because we want to make this a proactive screening tool whereby you look at patients who've got the risk profile, say, everyone who is above age 55, to take this quick, simple, and sensitive test. And patients get referred to secondary care with more sensitive and accurate detection tools, as opposed to subjective memory complaints or what a GP think could be, or a primary care physician think could be a problem. So this is a complete change of status quo, and one that we need, and we believe is one of the reasons that we have this public crisis, public health crisis.
It's always interesting to see how artificial intelligence is impacting future outcomes when it comes to healthcare. And one question we always ask our guests when we talk about AI is really the sort of human and machine partnership. When you look at AI in this scenario in terms of what you've been able to develop, can you talk a little bit about maybe why AI can do a better job than a human?
Great question. We can take it even a level higher and at a philosophical level. We say that there's this belief that humans will be replaced by AI. We don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. But we believe that those humans or those clinicians that they don't use this powerful technology will be replaced by the ones who use this. And this is exactly what we are doing here. Again, the analogy that we use, it's like a neurologist or it's like a specialist that does not forget every single patient that they see. All that information is being stored and used for the next patient who comes in. And not only one neurologist, every single neurologist or every point of access will collect this information and help our AI engine or algorithm to become more and more accurate as time passes. We're not standalone diagnostic tool. We provide a powerful data point for clinicians to make a better decision. And exactly to your point, this is going to be a partnership and where we can provide, the clinicians can provide better healthcare by using such powerful technology.
And so looking at where you stand today, where do you have the platform deployed at the moment? You know, who have you partnered with when it comes to pilot programs? And what kind of early results have you started to see? You know, how big a difference is it when it comes to that, you know, the doctor-patient relationship and diagnosing and going through this unfortunate, very, very sad experience?
We have deployments in three continents right now. We started from University of Cambridge in the UK. And as a result, we've got a lot of deployments in National Health Services of the United Kingdom. This is one of the biggest single payer and provider. We validated the technology in the NHS, and now it's the technology is being used in different settings from, as I said, proactive screening to monitoring patients post-diagnosis, and also helping the secondary care to have more accurate cognitive tests of patients. We're also in the Middle East. We made the decision to expand to the Middle East for two reasons. One, is because they are going to have, particularly United Arab Emirates, going to be the second fastest growing dementia population per capita. So they have the problem. And also we realized that they were the fastest country to vaccinate the entire population. So there is will and means in place to look at national programs as such. And it's been phenomenal. The adoption of the technology here has been fantastic. We have a deployment with one of the major government's healthcare provider in order to deploy the technology across their facilities. And this is for population health screening and monitoring and management. At the moment, when patients go see the doctors, the vital signs are taken, but there's no inputs, there is no collection for the brain. And this is across the world. What we're doing here is adding that to the picture, which is going to be very helpful for getting a better view of what the patient's health is, both with physical health and brain health. We are also in North America. The technology is being used in some interesting applications that we had not planned initially. For example, a chain of North American clinics are using our technology to monitor the response of the patients to treatment of depression. This is because similar to dementia, the disease results in cognitive impairment. So patients can't think straight, if you like, or the output of the brain drops as a result of the disease. And before we came along, they could not show the impact of the treatment in a longitudinal way and sensitive way. Now, by deploying our technology, because it's very sensitive, because it's very quick and it's not learnable, they can show over time that intervention is having a positive impact, which is very powerful and opens up many, many different applications for the technology.
Well, listen, we just wanted to thank you so much for everything that you're working on. You're right. I mean, this is a growing issue, and we all need to pay more attention to how we can actually come up with solutions. And we love seeing what you're doing. So thank you so much for joining us today and taking the time for the feed.
It was a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Stay with us. Up next, an inside look at plant-based eggs.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167. In the spotlight.
This is The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. Now, what if I told you the world's first plant-based sunny-side-up and poached eggs were coming to a restaurant near you in the U.S.? Well, the global plant-based eggs market is expected to rise an average of 27% year over year by 2027. Now, that's a big number, and no one is more excited about this news than Eran Groner. He's the CEO of Yo Egg, who has big expansion plans for North America and is joining us now. Thank you so much for being with us on the show. So I think the best place to start is most people don't think about eggs and being plant-based. So can you run us through the market size, the potential, and why plant-based sunny-side up and poached eggs?
So yeah, across alternative proteins, eggs are probably the least addressed market. There's plenty of innovation going on in alternative meat, especially burgers and alternative dairy. That's been around for over a decade, as well as yogurt and everything. But eggs is really one of those spaces that hasn't seen a lot of innovation in terms of plant-based solutions. And so that was actually why I co-founded the company together with my co-founders, is because we really thought the world needs a decent solution to eggs production and consumption. And so the market currently is relatively small, the plant-based landscape. And the main reason for that is there hasn't been suitable solutions, good products that have product market fit that were adopted by just everyday consumers, omnivores, not just vegans. And that is why the market is pretty much small. In North America is about, say, 40, 50 million altogether. But we really, you should expect it to grow rapidly as more and more products like ours that bring forward good solutions, products that are tasty and that nail it on texture and overall experience. That is when you'll start seeing the alternative egg market start growing in bigger numbers.
Can you talk a little bit about what these plant-based eggs are made of and kind of the science behind how you put this together?
Our eggs are based on chickpea protein and soy protein, and we take the color from carrot extract. The science behind it has been around for about a decade in molecular gastronomy. And what we managed to do is a being able to mass produce it because it's very labor intensive in any other way. And we patented our production technology to kind of mass produce it at cost efficient technology. So that's one. And second is being able to provide the egg with the right texture. That was a huge, huge achievement by our product development team. And to give it the flavor of an egg, that was also a huge, huge challenge right from the get-go. And we pretty much nailed it on texture as well as flavor.
It's really interesting that you mentioned texture and flavor. And I guess my question for you is, it's for all the things we use eggs for. So I'm interested to know, because, you know, eggs are so important and such a good alternatives in so many ways when it comes to cooking. So, and this is just from my own knowledge too, I guess. Did you test it with multiple ingredients from a cooking perspective? Because I just realized just how much I personally use eggs in so many dishes. So I imagine that's got to go into the process of research and development when you start to make a product like this.
It is said that you can cook an egg in more than 100 different ways. And so an egg is probably the most versatile of animal proteins that we humans consume. Eggs are, I mean, they can play a role as a center of plate dishes like sunny side up or scrambled or poached eggs, or serve as an ingredient like in a sandwich, hard boiled egg, or in a salad. And then as an ingredient in baking and even drinks. And so eggs are so, so versatile that it would make it almost impossible to create an egg from plants that can serve across all uses that traditional eggs do. And so we took a different approach. Every egg application will be a product with us. Okay, so we're building an egg company, and so we need to bring forward to consumers sunny side up. This is our first product, poached, our second product, and we're developing a hard boiled egg, a scrambled, an omelet, and baking solution. So each and every type of product for us is a single kind of product that undergoes a different research and development process.
It is incredible just to see what you've been able to create. And like you were talking about with Michael, just the versatility of eggs. We wanted to thank you so much for joining us on the feed. But most importantly, before everybody tweets at us and asks us where they can get access to your products, where is the best place for them to go to get more information?
Okay, so you can visit our website, yo-egg.com. And you can follow us at on our social media, Instagram and TikTok. If you want to try the product, the best place is probably Israel. We serve nationwide. But we're coming to North America this fall, starting with California.
Perfect.
Yes. And we're very excited to bring our Yo Eggs across food service, restaurants, hotels, anywhere nationwide by the end of next year.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
Up next, how artificial intelligence can improve astronaut training.
The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. For everything new, now and next on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167. Power Friend.
This is The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B. NASA is using automatic speech recognition to transcribe and analyze International Space Station communications to improve astronaut training and support space missions. To talk more about how this works and the future of ASR, we are joined by Clinton May, federal strategist at DeepGrand. Thanks so much for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yes. And I do want to just dive into what DeepGram does. So maybe let's start there and then we can work our way back to how you're helping astronauts.
Sure. So DeepGram is a deep learning way of doing automatic speech recognition. So we're an API, you give us audio and we give you back text. That's the simplest way to put it.
If that works, and let's not mistake it, that is very complex to do what you just said very simply. So when you take that concept, how is that being used in what we suggested off the top of this in the introduction by NASA, and why is this important?
So NASA has about the most difficult audio in existence. Deep learning is a great way to learn how to transcribe hard audio. So what we did for NASA was we trained a model and we taught our great general model, essentially gave it a master's degree in NASA audio. And we had NASA's help. NASA has a whole bunch of made up NASA acronyms. I joke, having listened to a lot of the audio, it's every fifth word they say is a unique word, the JAM or the TBAM or any number of unique government acronyms. And they gave us a list, about 7,500 that they expected might be in their space to ground audio. And we created training data, fed it to our model, and now our model knows what those words mean and knows how they're pronounced and knows what they sound like, and then they can transcribe it correctly. And that was the big issue, right? If you can't get a speech recognition system to get all those jargon words, what good is it to NASA? So that's what we did.
So let's talk a little bit more about some of the potential benefits. You know, we all hear about voice technology like this and the benefits. I can only imagine throughout the astronaut training process is one example that there could be lots of advantages. So can you dive into, you know, just some of the scenarios in terms of where this would be most useful?
So the first one I'd name is a problem that a C-level from NASA gave me permission to use this quote. He calls this a problem that's right in our faces. And that is that astronauts communicating to ground control, it's difficult for even a human to understand. A lot of terminology. Not everybody can memorize 7,500 acronyms, right? But our deep learning can. So it's an additional source of information, and it creates a record of all of these communications. So if they want to go back and search for a particular event, all of our words, our transcripts come back timestamped. They can find a phrase that indicates where something happened and then go dive in. Spacewalks take 8 hours. So they want to go find just that 5-minute period that they wanted to go look up, and they can do it with an accurate transcript and of course, creating a record for the future.
I wish we could do this in everyday scenarios, especially at work now. Do you see that we are or have become far more heavily reliant on voice technology for, you know, the everyday person listening? And do you think we take it for granted? We don't fully know or even realize that we are using some form of voice technology.
For sure. And it's become ubiquitous in the easy audio, right? Like if we're talking to our phone and we want to transcribe something when we're alone and in good audio conditions, we expect it to work. But I think that everybody here who's used some voice technology has had an experience where it wasn't optimal audio. And maybe there's a noise in the background, or there's other people speaking in the background, or the microphone isn't good. In those situations, like NASA has, you need a kind of a next generation speech recognition. And that's what we're conquering now. I think that's the delta between what we have today and what we're going to have tomorrow is the hard audio.
One last question for you. There are lots of competitors in this space, some bigger players, some smaller players. When we look at where DeepGram sits, I know you've won a number of awards. How confident are you in kind of the organization's innovative solutions to technology in the voice area?
Oh, it's just been fantastic. I'm one of the older hands at DeepGram, so I've gotten to see our growth and our wins. And it's a fantastic team. It's mostly scientists. It's like more than half, more than two thirds. And I've seen us win. The fun part about NASA is that they have their own validation set, a scorecard, where they have a big chunk of their spaced around audio, and they know exactly what the answer is. Like, they had humans listen to it and write down the answers. And so that's how they score us against the competition. You know, our model runs on that audio. It hasn't seen it before, and it matches up our answers to the known true answers. And I love to brag about this. I'm a former IBMer. I love Big Blue. But their speech recognition wasn't as good as ours. I came to DeepGram, and we beat IBM on NASA's scorecard. And seeing that, that makes me drink the DeepGram Kool-Aid a second time. So I have a lot of faith in it.
Love it. Well, listen, we wanted to thank you for joining us today on the feed, and thanks for breaking this down for us and for all of the work you're doing at DeepGram. We appreciate you being on the show.
Hey, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. All right. Well, that is it for today's show. Thank you for being here. Remember, you can tweet at us at Amber Mack and at MBancroft80. Please use the hashtag The Feed.
This is The Feed with Amber Mack and Michael B on SiriusXM Canada Talks Channel 167.